Welcome to Be Customer Led, where we'll explore how leading experts in customer and employee experience are navigating organizations through their own journey to be customer led and the actions and behaviors employees and businesses exhibit to get there. And now, your host, Bill Stakos.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Be Customer Led. I'm so jazzed up about the guest, about our guest today. I've been reading this individual's content for a couple of years. One of her newsletters, which comes out on Wednesday, and we'll talk about that in a second. She writes like, I feel like I'm so drawn to the writing because this person writes like Jack Kerouac in this crazy, awesome, frenetic, genius kind of, you know, way. And she just draws you into the writing, and your brain just starts thinking automatically. So, Dwenna Blumstrom, our guest today, is an author, keynote speaker, co-founder and CEO of People Not Tech and Emotional Banking. And she's got two weekly newsletters you can find on LinkedIn. One is called Chasing Psychological Safety. And we'll talk a little bit about that today. That comes out on Mondays. And then on Wednesdays, and the one that I'm a huge fan of, I love both, but the other one I'm a huge fan of, The Future is Agile. Dwenna, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so very much for having me, Bill. And I am not worthy of that very kind introduction.
Oh, you absolutely are. You have no idea. Like, I really look forward to your Wednesday newsletter, like no other newsletter out there. It's so much fun to read and really gets me thinking, because we've had this in a little bit of an exchange offline. And, you know, I am a huge fan of Agile, and I've been in the customer experience space for so long. The two of them are literally like twin brothers and sisters, right? And I'll get into this in a little bit before some of the, you know, just questions I want to ask you. But you said, hey, the disciplines are like one and the same.
And that's the same thing, yes. But let's
get into it. Yeah, so I want to get into it. But like, first, just help our listeners just understand your journey. How did you get to where you are? Why did you start People Not Tech, which is a pretty amazing name for a company to begin with? But like, tell us a little bit about that.
Thanks so much for that. I have to admit, this is the part I loathe most. I hate introductions. There's just no way to make them condensed and logical enough without boring everyone, in particular myself. But I will try for everyone's sake. So many, many years in technology, started from the human side. I have a background in psychology, took a sharp turn towards business and technology, have done a number of consultancies, have worked in various types of technology, anything from telecoms to banking. And then I have stumbled on fintech as fintech was starting. I was very lucky from that perspective and have seen essentially the growth of a digital bank, mm-hmm. if you wish, from no such thing as a digital bank to all the things you see around you today, which has meant a good 6, 7, 8 years or maybe 10 years of very sharp learning curve. And with it, understanding both the consumer side and the way the sausage is made on the back end of banks. So my journey has been through fintech. I have arrived at Agile simply because in order to make products that are looking at ways to satisfy the type of financial services that a consumer would like, you have to move fast. You have to be at Silicon Valley level, and yet you have these very antiquated organizations that are the big banks, which are finding it very difficult to undertake this journey. So it made me wonder why that is. One of my first indignations, as you mentioned, it was called emotional banking. I wrote a book mm-hmm. about this. It was essentially the fact that coming from a psychology background, I just couldn't comprehend why they wouldn't spend money and time figuring out how their consumer is feeling about their money. Where are these laboratories that they have in the background where they flash colors of money, or they ask you, once you're widowed, how would you like your pension to happen? None of that. And it got really upsetting after a while. So I left the fintech that was doing very well at the time. They still are, Meniga. Left it to kind of fix this in the world, because probably I was having a midlife crisis. And so went and spoke to a good few hundred bankers, I would suppose, in the space of a year, a year and a half, told them the same thing, which is you can, you have got to investigate your consumers' feelings. You have to become a human-centered organization. You have to use Agile to do that. And if you want to become a technology shop, then you have to understand that Agile in itself is a philosophy and that it's all about the humans in your enterprise. So I said all those two things, things to them for a good year or something. And then I realized it's just killing my soul. I'm just talking to them. They do nothing. I do nothing. Everyone goes home. So I went back to making a product, to make a long story short, wrote everything in the first book, put it out there. By the way, there's a second book coming out beginning of next year called
Awesome.
People Before Technology, The Importance of Psychological Safety and Teams in the Digital Age, published by Bloomsbury. And it's probably the first that I've seen where absolutely everyone's going to hate me at the end of this. Because what happened in my journey is that I've jumped ship, if you wish, from fintech to these other industries where it mattered, where I felt we could make a difference. And those industries would have had to have, if you call them industries, or those segments of business would have been more towards technology, Agile, and even slightly HR, much as I dislike the fact that that's the case. So in between those things, I just couldn't find a unifying platform. And to my mind, these things were so interconnected, it was shocking that there are different communities. But when I've entered these communities, I just decided we have to do our best to kind of find the commonalities between them instead of having cliques. Because the last thing I'll say is, what I found is we have a vast amount of what I call human debt. Just like we have technical debt in technical fashion, we have human debt. All the things we said we were going to be doing about humans and we didn't. The happiness, the engagement, the motivation, all the things we were meant to have worked out in terms of our humans and we did not. And that debt sits, yes, in theory with HR, but practically the only people that do anything about them are technologists and people that know that this Agile and this transformation and this digital will never happen until we spend time looking at our people. So I put my money where my mouth was and I started a software company that makes a product that makes teams more productive, happier, and more able to do Agile and customer experience.
You completely, now I need to go down this path. I'm going to completely throw away the question set that I had for you because you said some things that are really, that I think a lot about. And frankly, like one of the premises why I started this show altogether. So one is the human debt. And I want to explore that with you a little bit. Number two is this kind of, this completely new discipline almost that you're talking about, the confluence of people, technology, agile, this sort of human-centered design kind of mindset and way of life and working. Nobody is doing that today, right? In any organization, well or at scale. Right. And I think that probably you're right. I think there are probably some small startups that are doing that because they're small. It's probably one person wearing four or five different hats. So they're probably doing it without really saying, hey, this is a real discipline here and I can turn this into something. I feel like you see sometimes chief people officer, chief people and customer officer kind of popping up here and there. Right. But like, are they really doing it well? And are they doing it in an agile way? So Can we just talk about that one first, and then I want to talk about the human debt piece because it's the first time I've heard that phrase. So coin it and trademark it if you haven't already, and do it before this podcast actually goes live in a couple of weeks, please, because someone's going to do it if you don't. But talk to me about like how do you see that coming together, and how can organizations start to piece this together into a real discipline? What does that look like on the ground for you?
I wonder if it should be a discipline, if I'll be controversial. I simply think we need to be more conceptual of thinkers and more real of talkers in every levels of every organization. So in other words, I feel like this is obviously a leadership topic. So we shouldn't need a different discipline. Neither should we need different departments and so on. And you hit the nail on the head. Where you have people that are able to kind of embody in one human all of this bits we're talking about, things are going well. As soon as you don't, either because of size or because of loss of religion, then things start going to pots. And what we see, in big organizations in Silicon Valley is where they've walked away from the idea of departments and roles and job titles and disciplines, and they have just said, we have to boil this down to what is our religion? What do we truly believe in? And those organizations, like your Netflixes, your Googles, that truly believe in humans, They get it wrong multiple times. They're honest about getting it wrong. You'll see them in the press effing up here and there. But their philosophy will allow them to unify. So it's not a discipline, but it is. It's essentially culture. It's what we mean with culture. Sadly, it's culture and not all the silly things we're talking about, whether there's diversity or not, which I'm not saying is a minor point. It's just that we've coined the topic of culture differently in some other organizations. But to go back to it, I just think we all need to look at the commonalities. It needs to be a leadership topic. We need to boil it down to what we all truly believe in and what can we do if we roll our sleeves to see these things as one thing. You can't have agile before you've changed the way you're thinking. Mm-hmm. If you don't have agile, you can't employ technology. And if you don't have agile and you're changing the way you're thinking, you're not going to give the consumer things as fast or as good as you're trying to.
That's right.
And none of those things are going to happen until your humans are happy and working in a productive way. It's very simple, really.
I feel like you and I have the same, we're sharing a brain right now. Because I preach this all the time where I work today. You have no idea. And I frankly, I've seen, this is now my fourth rodeo, so to speak, with Agile. And I've seen the first three, well, the first two failed miserably. The third one, I think, was still going, but so much of it is being like, we're delivering quickly, we're delivering at scale, damn be the customer. Right? Like, and hey, how do I fit the customer in my 2-week sprint? I don't have time for this. I've got a lot of pressure. I've got to deliver quickly. I can't go and talk to the customer about this. I know what they want. I've been doing this for 25 years. Right? So, I love how you're thinking about, maybe it's not a discipline, but it's, you know, in an agile way, you have cross-functional teams or cross-functional organizations coming together to solve problems quickly, and call it culture, call it whatever you want. But how do we bring these elements together to get smarter, right? And deliver more quickly for our organization, who can then go take that and deliver more quickly for our customers.
You've packed so much into that. It's not even a question. That affirmation is so packed.
Absolutely.
For so many reasons. I have had chapters. So because the book I'm talking about is attempting to bridge this gap. So it's popularized science about psychology and popularized science about DevOps, if you wish. So both those communities are going to think I'm a dumbass, but that's all right. It's worth it so that everyone else kind of gets what we're on about.
Well, at least you know I'm going to buy the book. At least you've got one sale, right?
Very kind of you. But my point is, when I try to go deeper into, because I consider myself a hobbyist agile anthropologist, if you wish. So I'm like obsessed with how things go from an agile perspective. I think you've hit the nail on the head on a very big topic there, which is the speed that agile allows, in particular in a very formalized and process-driven scrum-like, I'd like to say, environment. Makes it really difficult to allow for the bits that are quote-unquote the fluffy bits. And that's a tragedy from many points of view. Because, first of all, the antidote to that is to understand that the fluffy bits are not fluffy. They will power on or unpower your efforts a long time. Secondly, you have, as a team, you have to realize that this is not something that the organization will magically fix for you. This is something you have to grow up, stand up, and take responsibility for. You have to think of the fluffy bits that are internal, the humans in your team, and the fluffy bits that are external, the humans you make things for. And you have to think about those obstinately all the time. If you don't have a habit of thinking of them, then you need like your agile coach, your scrum master, your product owner, whoever it is that leads that team to make the space for you as a team to think of topics, because it's not sustainable otherwise. Otherwise, you're going through motions. You become part of a little factory that just kind of throws out code that they don't know where it goes. They don't feel invested in. There's no real engagement. There's no psychological safety enough to ask what has happened. All of those things are going to come and bite the team no matter how fast they're going right now. And I think smart organizations, not big or small, smart organizations do stop to wonder, are we doing the fluffy stuff? Are we obsessively going, right, where's the human in this particular conversation? Take a minute. Where's you and I, and where's the customer? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we can't be having this next sprint unless we have that perspective.
So in those smart organizations, is it embedded in the agile team that product owner, the chief product owner, or whoever that is, the scrum master, how are they creating that space for their teams to do that? Because of that pressure to deliver quickly, right, that exists so much.
I have a big bone to pick with anyone who talks about the organization, if I'm honest. I feel like this conversation about the organization is just as useful as talking about Santa, for instance. So it upsets me when consultants talk about it and they make a living talking about the organization. Mm-hmm. We all cheer each other on to say how horrible it is, and it is, and it's a shared reality, and it's easy to commiserate. And some people make $5 and then nothing happens. I just find it so unsatisfying because it doesn't actually change anything. That's not the level at which we can change anything. We need a level where it's actionable. And the level where it's actionable is at the individual team level, the bubble mm-hmm. level, as I call it, which is why I'm so obsessed with psychological safety as the main lever to make that team focus on the human topics. And the human topics are incidentally not just their team topics, but the customer as well, both facets of the human topic. So I think first and foremost, team, whatever they are, team leaders, I hesitate to say team leaders, but I call everyone a team leader, whether you're CEO, a product owner, you're a team leader, some type of a leader of that team. Anyone like that should spend the time, get over the, oh my God, I can't believe this should be me still, and just get over it and say, yes, this is not something I'm voluntarily doing because it's difficult. The human work is the horrible bit that I have difficulties with. I'd much rather sit here and type. But I need to do it. It won't be up to anyone else but me to give my team permission to think of these things. And nobody expects a team leader to be doing all the human work, but they have to create the space. They have to offer the permission. They have to let people obsess about it and tell them this is a thing now. It's a real thing. We're not just wasting time.
So do you think that that's possible? And again, I go back to sort of the sprint kind of thing, right? Because that's the process that a lot of people follow. That's in the manifesto. That's all you got to do, right? Like, how do you create that space for people when they've got to deliver something every 2 weeks? I mean, do you say, forget the 2 week sprint, let's deliver in 3 weeks? How do you do that? Like, when you see companies practicing this, and I want to get to this, the psychological safety component, like, what do you think the building blocks and how people do that for their teams? And maybe we talk about it here now, but like, how do you do that consciously and with intent, right?
Exactly. That is the key word there, intent. And you know what? I'll be honest here and say that what we've created is a very complex piece of software with a really big, complicated algorithm behind it and loads of research. But it boils down to the fact that it's a very simple and very primary and very like basal fact, which is it allows people the space to take the breath, to think of the human bit, transform that into a task, and literally copy and paste it into their normal Trello or Jira as one of the tickets for the next sprint. And that minute connection between the fluffy theoretical human bits and the practical sprint part has made a humongous difference to all. It took us a year and a half to work out how small of a point and how much team leaders needed some form of a connection being made. They got it theoretically, but they wanted a practical way to move from let's just talk about it to actually doing something. So once you turn it into an action, which is what we advise they do. So we take all of this data in, we ask questions, we analyze behavior, and it ends up in a dashboard that we encourage them to look at just so that they have a space. They won't understand precisely all the components.
Sure.
It doesn't matter that they know how to calculate anything exactly on their own. Nobody asked them to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but what they do need to do is to take the space and the time to look at it, wonder what's happening with us as a team, and then have an idea of an action, no matter how minute, that they can then transfer into their daily to-do in a Jira or a Trello. That alone has made a humongous difference.
You've absolutely just blown my mind right now, and I never would have thought about that. Like, because I deal with this all the time. How are we going to do this in this 2 week sprint? Just put it into the technology that they use already. Like, that's so simple and genius. It's just, I'll
put that on our next C round financing when we're going to overtake.
Good. I hope you do. So let's talk about the building blocks of psychological safety. I know that you write about this a ton. You think about it a lot. I actually downloaded I think your website, and we'll talk about this towards the end of the show, it's like a free like test or whatever it was, right? Like a download. I send it to my chief product owner, one of the chief product owners at our company. It's like, hey, check this out. Tell us a little bit about psychological safety in the team and why that's important and what does that do to outcomes?
But by the way, considering when you did send that, if they do get in touch, they can still get that free COVID offer we were doing.
Because that's what it was, yeah.
When COVID hit, is we just thought there's no way we're going to bridge that gap between technology and HR now. Mm-hmm. We might as well just kind of get people on the thing so they have the right continuity in their work, in particular with remote becoming sudden and so on. But yeah, to backtrack a bit, I'll tell you the story as shortly as I can. I don't know if I can. So we started with a different product. We pivoted 3 or 4 months into our company's life because it was very clearly the wrong pathway. We were going down the wrong garden path. And that garden path was we were trying to make a product called Dream Teams. Mm-hmm. It was taking in some information. It was adding to the data you already had from all your systems in the back end. And then AI was spitting perfect teams. So we thought we invented this magical way of doing teaming, and we loved it, until we realized after we read enough and we tried enough that it's absolutely BS, because it doesn't actually matter who you put in a team. It matters how that team interacts and what kind of dynamic you can make in it. So we had this very difficult conversation with our developers, who are already having difficulties having to explain to their families why they work for a company called People, not Tech, when they're software developers. And we went like, you know, all that stuff we made that's beautiful, we're not going to be doing that at all anymore, because that was a horrible mistake. So what we need to do is something that affects the way teams work. So we realized that psychological safety is the only dynamic that matters mm-hmm. in a team. And so that was our first step. We looked at what existed out there. If I'm honest, I'm a platform person. I've done platforms before in financial technology. And I looked what was out there thinking, I'll put all these things together and we'll have a platform to diagnose it. But because we were starting with diagnose at the time. But in honesty, I couldn't find anything. So we had to start figuring out from scratch, what does psychological safety even contain? Because at the point we found it, it was an academic definition that said, teams are happy to take interpersonal risks, happy to open up, they're happy to speak up, they're never afraid, they're not censoring themselves. Great, clear explanation. And then if you looked in more depth, you'd find the Google study, which helped the industry enormously to open their eyes to it, which said at the end of 35,000 people, the most number one thing, doesn't matter who you buy, what you pay them, where they're from, what kind of education they have, what matters is, does this team have the magic of psychological safety or not? Mm-hmm. So those things existed, but anything for me to put it together into a platform, I couldn't find. So we had to start from zero, decompose it. What does it mean? What's in it? What do I measure? I can't make an algorithm look at some fluffy, magical thing. It needs to understand what these questions map to. So after we've worked on it a few months and we worked with specialists and we asked hundreds of people, what we ended up with was we are now measuring 6 different things. We're measuring, is a team flexible? Is a team resilient? Because that flexibility over time does not necessarily transform in resilience, on the contrary. Is a team learning together? Are they courageous? Are they speaking up? 2 different components. And then lastly, what's their engagement like? Which is just one part of the many things that sure. we look at. And so once we have that picture of how they're doing on those things, which we measure by asking people, not only asking them questions, but also measuring how they interact with the app. We have a big behavioral component. Yep. They might, you know, kind of answer something incognito. They might skip a question. They might answer 100 questions. All of those things are signals as to how they are behaving with us and not just what they said. And then lastly, In the dashboard that we ask the team to use as a space, we also highlight as alarms whenever they engage in negative behaviors. And there's one major negative behavior we're going to be speaking about, by the way, at DAS. Jean Kim has made my ear by saying we could do that. We're going to be talking about impression management, which is the dark side of psychological safety, which is mm-hmm. essentially whenever you stop yourself from speaking up because you're afraid, and you're afraid of looking incompetent, you're afraid of looking like you don't know something, you're afraid of looking ignorant, you're afraid of looking negative or intrusive. If you're afraid of those things, you don't speak up, then you already have low psychological safety and mm-hmm. it's dropping. So in this space, we ask a team to look at it. This is how you're doing. This is how engaged you are. This is how you're learning together. Now, could it be connected to how you're afraid? When was it that you didn't speak up because you were afraid not to look negative? Can we talk about it? Is there anything we could be doing? Can we be more courageous? Can we laugh more? Can we have more beer? Whatever it is that we can do as a team to progress and to tighten us and to make us be on a road to psychological safety.
And if you're not doing that stuff, that's where the human debt component comes in, starts to build and starts to erode the team, the success of that team, the way they operate, the what they're delivering.
Precisely.
Amazing.
You see it in Agile KPIs. In fact, last thing I'm going to say is I tried something quite out there. It didn't work out, if I'm honest, which was I was hoping to connect Agile KPIs to psychological safety for the first time. So for the book, I had this chapter planned, which was going to be measuring directly in Agile KPIs, what like A-B testing is one team, mm-hmm. certain level of psychological safety, and then one of them we would work on and see what the difference is for a few months. And to my surprise, finding organizations that are doing Agile KPIs has, let's say, proven to be a challenge. You can see more in the
book. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's probably why they fail too, or those transformations fail. All right, let's get into a little bit of your comment at CX and Agile are the same discipline, right? So I'm a huge believer in working with Agile teams, training them, coaching them how to develop personas, how to develop journeys, how to measure performance. And I'm actually a big believer in using analytics throughout the journey and not so much have product teams have Agile teams that are aligned to the journey. That's sort of like my big thing that I'm trying to get to now. Get out of the product silo, get into the journey silo. You know, using analytics to measure how are we performing those activities. I mean, there's so much data in every organization and the technology is cheap. You can actually do that. So you can prioritize the backlog. You can measure performance against those 2-week sprints across your PIs, et cetera. We're doing that today, right? But you're saying, no, it's the same discipline. So I'm curious of what you meant by that. And like, you know, because the toolkit is different, right? But you're saying it's the same discipline. So I'm curious to understand your definition there.
Good one. So, well, first of all, you're not the norm, obviously, if you're doing any of that.
That's kind of you. I take that as a huge compliment.
It is. It absolutely is. Like people don't do that. And I think we need to always go back to, I know it sounds fanatic, but the manifesto was a piece of genius for a second, as it was. And I'm not discussing the people, what happened to it,
sure.
The disciplines, just the manifesto in itself. And if you look at that phrase that says people before process, I believe they meant, and from my conversation with some of the signatories, that's the case. They meant both sides of the equation, people. They meant our people and the people we make something for, whoever mm-hmm. those people are, i.e. the customer. And I think loads and loads of teams are in a horrible position where they are flying blind with a huge dissociation between what they are told is their end consumer, which can be so far away from what they're doing day to day that they have no idea whatsoever as to any kind of impact, any kind of effect, any kind of relationship that they would have with the end consumer. So I think, again, the manifesto is genius from that perspective. There shouldn't be any, it should be illegal and against human rights to have a team that's working. It should be that's working without actually saying any impact of their work to the customer. Because it is like you said, there's a way to split that into seeing mm-hmm. bits and pieces of effects. I don't care what it is, whether it's like you can change the background of your email address whenever someone saw something you did and that line of code changed the way their week went. There's so many ways in which you could accomplish this right. So that people see impact. And I'm not talking about, it's easy when you have a short feedback loop, right? If you make something, if you're a doctor, you're going to most times, in particular if you're the ER medicine, you're going to see you saved a life. There's no doubt about it. You brought someone back from the dead. If you're a GP doctor, I say this to teams sometimes, you might not. You might completely lose track of that patient. You might never know what happened to your referral. If you don't end up having an end view of what happened to your recommendation, then you don't see impact. You don't feel the same way. So obviously, very different examples than in software.
Sure.
But with that said, you're even further away. You make some piece of code that you have very scant idea how that affects anyone's life. And while I understand it's a very far away journey to show how it affects the wheels on the track at the end of the mm-hmm. logistics chain, you can absolutely see how it affects the next team that you push that change to. You can absolutely see how it helps some management dude, or on the contrary, how it made the change in the company. There are ways to show impact, and it is absolutely important that we find them, I think.
So the one way that I think about this, and what we're trying to do is there's customer experience management platforms like Medallia and Qualtrics and all these other big platforms out there. They allow you to do like any kind of surveying you want. They allow you to analyze all that data in the platform. They allow you to bring disparate sources together, right? And think about the contact center calls. Think about notes that people are taking. Think about sort of the digital exhaust off of people's platforms, like, you know, Microsoft Workplace Analytics. There's like five or six other tools that are like capturing all the stuff that people are doing. If you can bring all this data together, right, and say, okay, our customers are telling this through the journey. Here are the contact center calls that we're getting about this topic. They're either the sentiment is improving or it's getting worse, right? Like, if you can put that into the hands of the product owner as a dashboard and say, here's the journey and here's exactly where you touch it, and that sentiment is getting positive or negative, then they can say, ah, you know what? I actually have something in the backlog. It's number 4,180 in here, but let me pull that up and actually I can reprioritize that and fix this and make this little light go from red to green, right? So like the technology is there. I mean, some of it is expensive in all fairness, but the data is all there for sure. It's about how can companies bring it together to put that into the hands of those teams that are there to fix stuff for the organization and for the company. Sorry, I won't use organization anymore, right? But and for the customer, in that sort of 2 week kind of let's sprint this out, let's come together and let's solve the solution for and bring and do it in a way and just have like a mini sort of design thinking workshop in that 2 week sprint to say here's how we're going to solve it. Okay. Get that to the designers, the developers, et cetera, and then it's out the door. And then hopefully a week later, those contact center calls start coming down. The kind of, you know, it starts to go from red to amber to green, hopefully over time. And then you say, I did it, right? And it's not, you didn't bring someone back from the dead, but hopefully in 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks, when that data starts coming through, you start to see that change and the team can just love that success together, right?
Very, very true. And look, I don't think you're claiming or I'm claiming that this is an easy thing to do, right?
Oh, no.
No, it's a very difficult thing. For instance, I'm a product owner for our own platform. So I know firsthand that there are days in which I'm like, I don't even want to sit around and explain to people why this item is like, this is, you have to believe me, this bloody talk. Yeah. We don't do this now. This is not the time. So I have more constraints than others because I can see them from a CEO. Then I can't pay you your salary if people don't understand that this is more. So it's not, people don't have a short of feedback loops. But even if you do have a short one, the human work still has to be intentional. Yes, it's a slog. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it costs money and time. The problems we have, and the reason we have so much human debt, is we have created it every time we chose not to bring everyone along on the journey. Every time we chose to not show those connection points. Every time we made the decision, we're not going to be human today. We created more human debt, and it costs money. It's going to cost catastrophic money. It's not going to cost money here and there. It's going to cost money to where one day the gap between us and the company that's been doing it all along is going to be too great to bridge.
It multiplies. It gets exponential, right? It's exponential in the team, then teams broader than sort of business, broader than clients. And as you go further out in the rings, there's a multiplier effect. Totally, totally agree. Let's talk a little bit about you. So you mentioned a lot of teams don't have agile KPIs or maybe OKRs, if you want to call it that, which I'm shocked by, right? I mean, like, I've always seen that as like, if you don't do that, you're not actually really doing it. So I'm curious, in your experience, how pervasive that is. And I want to talk about, so you wrote recently in one of the recent ones, the last week or two, in your weekly newsletter, The Future is Agile, you talked about rollbacks. And organizations out there are saying, oh, this is too hard, or maybe COVID made this more difficult, or, you know, and I see that a lot. Again, I said, you know, four times, first two definitely failed miserably. Tell me a little bit about what you're seeing there and why that's happening, why you think that's happening.
Terrifying. I think that's happening because people need excuses. And I think it would have happened some way or another, but it would have had to have been one of those failed transformations that McKinsey can count as why you shouldn't be doing agile. And feel free to eliminate McKinsey from your podcast.
No, it's okay. We're not here to like say one company is better than the other.
No. I use McKinsey very broadly as a consulting before conversation, right? I just think it's non-controversial, but probably wrong. My point is, I should have learned it wrong. Forb got upset with me one time.
It's all right.
Yeah, that's a funny story for a beer. So essentially what that would have come out in the wash as another failed transformation anyways, I think. They were too early, they were too hasty, they never had a serious cultural push where it was about the humans and the mentality change. And a lot of this work for becoming agile has been process-driven, made by the deck of some Big Four, mm-hmm. and not with enough journey buy-in from everyone, not stakeholders only, but everyone. So you're going to have this. I find it almost the opposite in some agile prospects. Instead of having a frozen middle, you have a hot middle where there's loads and loads of people that are invested. And then you have very low down people that hadn't gotten to that point and that just pulled along on this process and they loathe it. And then you have very top people that they have never understood why in the hell we're walking away from waterfall. And they, between these two things, the middle alone will just give up at one point and we're going to see quote-unquote rollbacks. Now, the COVID conversation just complicates everything horrendously. And obviously, we've lived through an example of extreme VUCA, and it bedazzled everyone and people took different learning mm-hmm. out of it. Ideally, I am still hopeful, but starting to doubt it, that people have taken the learning of we have got to be resilient. We have got to be prepared for really big shifts. We have to learn something from a human perspective out of this. But with that said, we can't really tell until a couple of years down the line when the rhetoric goes away and the reality sets in. And I'm afraid that some of these rollbacks are an example of reality setting in. In particular for teams that were, like to connect it back to the beginning of your questions, they weren't having the right type of measurements. They were having some set of measurements that they had downloaded with whatever software they were using. They mean nothing to them, some of which they don't even know what's a speed? The speed of which? Because they don't have that feedback end with the end consumer. And on top of everything, they're only measuring two or three things that, as I said, might be irrelevant. No one's measuring things that are intensely emotionally important to them, themselves as a team. Nobody is. I mean, if you stop to think about it, other than the health check in some Scrum processes, there's not a peep about how we as humans exist around here. Mm-hmm. And that just makes it difficult to understand the human element of it and really get it in. And if you don't, it's not sustainable. It's not a change of mentality. These people haven't understood the fact that you have agile is really an uncomplicated topic of you make things fast, you pick them up from this middle row, which is a bucket. We all pick them collaboratively because we're all trying to make the world a better place. We love each other, we get out the other side with our consumers loving us back. It's not difficult, but we're never going to make it until we change minds and souls and not just processes.
Man, I on some level, I hope that COVID has been sort of the way that kind of brings the employee back into focus. So hopefully that starts to come together for people, right? We're doing agile today. Oh gosh, our employees are really important. How do we think about these two together? To be able to create that psychological safety. And then all the stuff going on in the US with all the racial injustice as well, that's created a whole new set of conversations. So I love how you're bringing those two together. I hope more people and any listeners certainly of this podcast can go back and talk to their leadership teams and start to bring that stuff together. All right, I'm really curious because I get inspiration from you. Where do you go get your inspiration from?
Very, very kind. So I'm a big Jim Kim fan to the point that my child must be thinking he's like part of some boy band or something about him. So kind of I've asked every banker I've ever met to buy and read the projects and give them to everyone in their team because it reads like Chiclet, but for DevOps, and people are going to start going, oh my God, that's my life. I get this. So he's an amazing kind of chronicler of himself and his quarters of what's happening. I find I love the DevOps community. It's a sad thing that it's a community and it's not, you know, kind of, I'll put it differently. It's a sad thing that the DevOps community is such an exclusive circle of people. But if you look at them, each and every one of them are some amazing humans with astounding ideas who have done incredible things. They're modest AF as well. Mm-hmm. But they have essentially taken this role of comprehending the bigger picture of how to make good things fast with happy enough of employees by using technology. That role has shifted from all parts of the organization, I feel, to the DevOps community. So if I had to take inspiration from anyone, it would be anyone who defines themselves as DevOps.
Got it. That's awesome. Okay, so where can folks find you? Please talk about your website, your company a little bit. Let's hopefully we can drive some traffic to you and get people really getting a better understanding of how to do this stuff the right way.
Very kind. If you guys or anyone listening to this wants their teams to be having a better dynamic and as a result more productive, as a result agile, then there's a website called www.psychologicalsafety.works where there's a little bit about the actual solution. It has resources in there. We have a YouTube channel. There's you know, all of these, thank you for mentioning them, newsletters. Yep. Please subscribe to those because I keep talking about what we do in terms of, it's a little bit of a product journal as well, where I try and take people on a journey as to why we're making what we're making. But essentially, it's a really simple, we say this all the time, even if people don't buy our software, just start educating yourself about psychological safety. Just comprehend how important it is to have your humans taken care of and spent time on and the team dynamic worked on, and you'll be in a completely different place and with a much better chance of becoming an elite performer.
Amazing. Dwenna, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a great conversation. I think people are going to learn a ton out of this from you specifically. And again, folks out there, follow Dwenna, get her on her newsletters. You will become a smarter, better human for it. Thanks so much, Dwenna. Great to see everybody. Thanks, everyone. Another episode of Be Customer Led. Have a good one.
We're out. Talk to you soon, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Be Customer Led with Bill Stakos. We are grateful to our audience for the gift of their time. Be sure to visit us at BeCustomerLed.com for more episodes. Leave us feedback on how we're doing or tell us what you want to hear more about. Until next time, we're out.